to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This case is A23-1261. Michael L. Pogreba, could someone pronounce that for me, please, counsel?
Pogreba.
Pogreba, thank you. Michael L. Pogreba, respondent, versus Lorraine Pogreba et al. Defendants. Janet Bowen et al. Appellants. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. When you are not speaking, I ask that you keep your keep the mute on. During your principal argument, I ask that you state your name and the parties that you represent for the record. We are doing this, we're conducting this oral argument on Zoom. We maintain only an audio version for posting later on our public website. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose to use that. And with that, we are ready to hear from you, counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Christina Hopke from Rinke Newton on behalf of appellants. There are a number of appellants in this matter, and a number of those appellants share the same last name as respondent. So for simplicity and clarity today, I'm going to refer to the parties by some of their first names. I'll use James and Marilyn for appellants and Michael for respondent. James and Michael are brothers and grew up on what is referred to in the briefs and today as the farm property. The farm property today is about 112-acre set of parcels, which consists of one of the parcels being Government Lot 1, except the east 16 acres. Government Lot 1 is why we're here today. Government Lot 1 contains approximately 52 acres. In 1933, the east 16 acres of Lot 1 were sectioned off from the remainder by deed. Today, James and Michael own the farm property jointly with their siblings. Michael solely owns the east 16 acres of Lot 1, which has been termed the lake property because it is along Thunder Lake in Todd County. Before I get into the application of law to the facts of this case, I'd like to take a moment to identify for the court five foundational principles at work here, and then I will expand on those further. First, there's a historical remnant of the federal government's original land survey that is called a meander line. This crude line was run around lakes back in the 1800s for purposes of selling off land into private ownership. In most cases, this line was a ways off from the actual lakeshore, meaning that it was a ways outside of the lake, just as it is here. Second, despite the existence of meander lines, property located along lakeshore is bounded by the lake. That property is not bounded by the meander line, but instead the property goes to the lake. If this was not the case, there'd be no such thing as riparian rights in this state. Third, this state's case law makes abundantly clear that the meander line is not the boundary, and that the meander line became essentially immaterial after the land passed into private ownership. The fundamental exception to this is where a deed expressly references or describes the meander line. Fourth, the deed—
Counsel, I don't mean to disrupt your flow, but your time will go quickly, and I just want to make sure that I understand your argument. So your last point about the meander line, I read the district court's decision as disagreeing with you that the meander line becomes— I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but something like meaningless, in that the district court wrote about the meander line being perhaps relevant evidence in the case where the deed is ambiguous. Now, do you agree with that? Disagree with that? Do you have case law that will point us in the right direction? Help me out on that.
Of course, Your Honor. So we disagree with the district court's attempt to square this state's well-established case law with the deed in this case. The case law is ample, dating back from and starting with Schermeyer in 1865, Everson in 1890, Great Northern Railway Co. in 1895, and In re Tucker in 1914, all of which predate this 1933 deed carving off the lake property. And those cases are very clear that the purpose of the meander line, was to create a accrued acreage amount so that the federal government could section that land up. Now, there is an exception. Council,
just to be clear again, it's just because our time is short. I believe the district court's opinion agrees with you on that point, what the original use of a meander line is. The question I'm trying to ask, and maybe I apologize if I'm not being clear, is that and I'm asking to bump ahead a bit, you know, and just assume for the moment, for the purposes of this discussion, that the deed is ambiguous. So is the meander line, the district court reasoned it was, relevant evidence in part because of the ambiguity of the deed. So I'm not hearing your answer is going to that. You're going back to the history of the use of meander lines. And I'd like to understand it in the context of an ambiguous deed.
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize. It's a complex issue and a couple of things layered together. But so to get to the...
And believe me, your brief is, you know, well done. You've got lots of legal authority. We've spent some time studying it. So we're just trying to hone in on the precise points that you allege are arguing today are the errors, especially the legal errors of the district court, since the factual issues are also complicated here. And there's a lot of evidence to sort through. And of course, you know, our standard of review on that is pretty generous to the district court. So I'd like to hone in on any legal errors that you see in the district court's analysis.
Yes, Your Honor. So first off, the district court actually found that the language in the deed is not ambiguous. And so we agree on that part as well with the district court. The district court sort of went against what this court has said in previous cases, which is that there is recognized survey methods to deal with what we might consider an ambiguity on the ground or how to locate a deed that is otherwise unambiguous on its terms. And then the district court also, the decision is sort of in contrast and contrary to what this state's case law says is sort of the core exception to the meander line rule that it becomes immaterial is where the deed sort of expressly calls that out. And so there's no language in this lake property deed, even if there is an ambiguity in how we locate it on the ground, we don't resort to sort of hints that might be in some 1800s survey that a meander line existed. Instead, we look to the recognized methods of surveyors to just locate what the deed says, but the deed itself is not ambiguous. Instead, it would be just locating that deed on the ground through survey methods instead of in creating this idea that is contrary to the state's case law that the subsequent purchaser should have been reading the tea leaves kind of for any hint that the meander line might have remained relevant under the one exception recognized in Henry Gridley. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
If you think it does, go right ahead. I'm just not hearing a precise response on the use of a meander line when the deed is determined to be ambiguous. Apparently, I guess I have a different reading of the district court's decision.
Well, Your Honor, what I would say maybe direct answer is this state's case law recognizes only two exceptions to the default. One is where the Sherwin case, the body of water just isn't substantially found in the place that the original plat showed. Those are kind of considered a line of sort of fraud cases where the body of water just isn't there. The only other exception is the In re Gridley case, where the parties to the original instrument make clear an intent to use the meander line. There isn't another exception for sort of, well, the deed is unambiguous, but we have to go apply it to the ground. And instead of looking to the recognized methods of a survey, surveyors, we create a potential third avenue for the meander line to come back into the question, which is really contrary to the foundational principles of fairness and notice that we consider behind deed descriptions. So,
doesn't the reason that the district court was very one thing that influenced the district court to consider the meander line wasn't just, you know, because it existed somewhere, it's because the deed talked in terms of acres. And when you look at the government survey, I mean, it was it was, you know, that it all matches up from the government survey on to 16 acres here to 112 here and 40 here, ending up to 168, not taking into account then that omitted part. And it seems like for that reason, the district court said, when you look at that, like the 1903 original deed and then how it traces through, that they were measuring acres by relationship to the median, or excuse me, the meander line, not to the lakeshore. And that's why it has special relevance, or that's why I guess it seems to be extrinsic evidence maybe of an ambiguous deed.
And Your Honor, respectfully, we just disagree that that's sufficient enough evidence to come under the exception to the default rule. I mean, you're asking all these subsequent purchasers to understand that this simple math basically adds back up to what the original survey said, which there hadn't been another survey to sort of correct those. It doesn't make it's not unreasonable that the acreages continue to be the same because that's what the part, you know, consistently was there from time to time. But that isn't clear enough indication to future parties that there was an intent to rely on the meander line as locating that acreage. And additionally, the next piece of the error that the district court made was if the meander line becomes relevant again for this 16-acre deed, then that's the extent of the grant of the deed. It detaches the riparian rights. The district court instead said that Michael can have it both ways. He can locate the 16 acres on the meander line and then also acquire title to the additional 14 acres between the meander line and the lake. I mean, that's a substantial amount of acreage in this case that lies between its completely agreed upon. There's 14 approximate acres between the meander line and where the lake is. And so Michael's sort of gotten this windfall of not only was the deed, there no hint in the deed that the meander line was supposed to remain relevant for locating this property, but then also he received an additional 14 acres that wasn't specified in the deed. It's a strict acreage deed. And so the case law on how to interpret deeds says that that property and parcel is limited to the acres specified in the deed. And somehow we got to from a 16 acre deed to about 29 acre parcel. So I've gone through what, you know, our understanding of the case law on the meander line and the recognized exceptions, and looking specifically also at this court's decision in Hess v. Nines, which I recognize is not a published decision, but those same principles of fairness and notice and just the ability to take the plain language of a deed for what they mean to all parties, subsequent purchasers alike, that those principles were similar in this court's rejection of the concept of meander acres. I mean, a flat out rejection of that concept, which isn't the language used here, but is the same idea that there should be something beyond what is called out for the specific acreage in the lake property deed.
So can I go back to the 14 acres and understand? I mean, I believe I understand your argument that the court shouldn't have been looking at the deed for, or the, well, I'm going to mix this up. But when we get to the other deed that gives a number of 112.2 acres, right, for the farm, is it the farm parcel then?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And so, but wouldn't that add 14 acres to that 102 then? I mean, those 14 acres have to go somewhere, don't they?
Correct, Your Honor, they do. And by nature, the way that the farm property deed is written, it is the place where those 14 acres go. If there is extra acreage discovered in government lot one, it goes to the holder of that farm property deed where the grant says all of government lot one less the east 16 acres. The case law for interpreting and constructing deeds says that where you have these other calls, those are what control. So the farm property has all of lot one except the 16 acres. And where you have a strict acreage deed, that deed is limited to that acreage. So that property can only ever have 16 acres.
And so what am I reading that says containing 112 and 12 one-hundredths acres according to the plat thereof, blah, blah, blah?
It's a supplemental description, Your Honor. That's how the case law describes it.
It's so it's because it's supplemental that you could change that to add the 14 to that.
Correct. And most of those deeds even say more or less. They have that verbiage in it to sort of call to that recognition of the case law that it's supplemental. But even if it didn't, still the preceding calls in the farm property deed are what control based on the state's case law. And that 112 number is just a supplemental. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. The remainder of lot one, less the east 16 acres, still goes to the farm property. So the district court concluded that Michael's proposed resolution, the ambiguity was acceptable, even though the five expert surveyors all agreed they'd never seen the underline used in surveying a deed before. The district court looked to kind of two categories of evidence, which again, we feel are not sufficient to get under, again, the exception recognized in Avery Gridley that says by default, in this state, meander lines become irrelevant unless you fit into this category where there's a clear intent otherwise. And sort of, again, the simple addition of math that it's not clear we can even expect subsequent purchasers to be aware of and look back to, doesn't meet that burden and threshold. The district court compounded that error by then concluding that Michael was entitled to the 14 acres between the meander line and the lake. And the district court's decision is contrary to the state's case law and not supported by the facts. With that, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent. You can hit your unmute button. We'll start over, Mr. Johnston.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Justice Smith, Scott Johnston for respondent Michael Pogreba. Appellants today are asking that you overturn the trial court's decision, which was rendered in favor of respondent. Appellant's basis for this request relies on their asserted notion that a meander line becomes meaningless in determining boundary lines once the U.S. government sells a meandered government lot to the first private party purchaser. Appellants ask you to rule that in determining boundary lines to portions of government lots abutting meandered lakes, those boundary lines must be determined by locating the shoreline as it exists at the time that a modern survey is prepared. This method of determining boundary lines would have the court ignore extrinsic evidence arising prior to that modern survey that provides context and understanding of how the original grantor and grantee intended to set such boundaries. Appellant's argument seeks to ignore evidence of the intention of prior owners in describing their parcels, is unsupported by applicable case law, and flies in the face of the trial court's thorough analysis in this matter. Going back to that 1903 deed, Plaintiff's Exhibit 13 at trial, conveyed the east half of the northwest quarter in government lots 1 and 2, stating that according to the United States government survey, it contained 168.12 acres more or less. That was back in 1903. At trial, appellants attempted to make much of the fact that people driving around then in Model T cars couldn't hope to know of the existence of the U.S. government survey, and yet a 1903 did speak to that. We submit that this language is evidence that prior owners were mindful of the original government survey and the acreage above the meander line, and supports our assertion of the intention of past grantors to use those meander lines to determine acreages. There are numerous additional trial exhibits that talk about the 152.12 acres, the 112.12 acres, including appellant's predecessors in title. The 1933 deed, where the east 16 acres, the parcel at issue today, was first split off, was admitted at trial as Exhibit 15. And that was given to a man by the name of Steve Wishala. Steve Wishala was Mabel Goligoski's father. He was Donald Goligoski's grandfather. Donald Goligoski testified at trial as to where he understood the west boundary of the 16 acres to be.
Counsel, if again, I apologize for interrupting you. The facts are laid out well, and I think in the district court's decision and in the party's briefs. So I just want to, if I can, get to this, our reading of, say, the 1933 deed, and I think your argument that shows an intent to rely on the government survey, the original government survey. Could you explain that, please? I know that the district court has its explanation for it. I'd appreciate it if you would also explain that. So, for instance, why, in your thinking, does the district court determine that we can't understand the terms, the acreage term, without reference to the survey, the original government survey? Thank you.
Because of the ambiguity of the legal description as it applies on the ground. All the surveyors agreed
to be clear, the ambiguity that is on the ground, so in the application of this deed to the actual land, as opposed to in a plain reading of it. 16 acres,
yes, Your Honor.
Means 16 yes. acres. We know where those 16 acres begin and end. Is that right? Or we don't?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I'm sorry if I'm being confused. I'm just trying to understand whether you're saying the language of the deed is ambiguous or whether it is only as it is applied to this particular property.
As applied to this particular property, where the legal description of the E16 acres is applied on the ground, all five surveyors agreed that the legal description was ambiguous.
And if you go to the next step, so assuming I'm with you and I see the ambiguity, why is it then the ambiguity suggests in the language of the deed that it is the intent of the original grantors to make reference to the survey and understanding that term 16 acres? I'm trying to really, and maybe I should be a little more direct. The argument that appellant's counsel is making that, you know, the deed says 16 acres, and now suddenly, as a result of this action, your client has 29 acres. I mean, that doesn't seem to make sense. And we have to get from, I know you think it does, and you'd like us to affirm it. So I'm trying to understand what's the core legal principle that you rely on or the line of reasoning to get there. Thank you.
The line of reasoning is if you come back and use the acreage above the meander line as shown on the original government survey, that supports the 112.12 acres on appellant's deed and the 16 acres on respondent's deed. But everyone knows, and everyone at the surveyors testified to a trial, that there is additional acreage, not only in respondent's 16-acre parcel, but also in appellant's 112.12-acre parcel. And that's because of the additional land line between the meander line and the shoreline. Everyone agrees that riparian lands in Minnesota extend to the shoreline. And so there's this, in this case, a significant amount of acreage between the meander line and the shoreline. And that accounts for this extra 14 acres, so to speak, that the respondent's survey shows that respondent owns, and likewise appellants have significant additional acreage in government lots 1 and 2 between the meander line and the shoreline.
Thank you for the explanation, but I would like you to take it, if you would, to the next step, because the appellant's argument is that 14 acres, really, given the way the deeds, the two deeds, when they're read together, the farm property and the lake property, that the 14 acres that we're talking about that's now been allocated to the lake property really should have gone to the farm property, since the farm property suggests that it includes everything except that very precise 16 acres. So...
Sure.
Are you following my question? I apologize if I'm not being
I do, started. Your Honor. And so that brings us back to the deeds themselves. So the deeds of record show the 112.12 acres and the 16 acres, which added up down to the hundredth of an acre to the 128.12 acres that was contained in that southeast quarter
Counsel, we've lost your audio. You and Marshall maybe take a pause on the clock. Thanks. Nope. Do you have a plug-in? Or no, it's just the... there we go.
Can you hear me now?
We can. Okay.
Okay, my apologies. So what we come back to is that the deeds of record add up down to the hundredth of an acre to the 128.12 acres shown in the original government survey, which was for the southeast quarter of the northwest quarter. It contained 40 acres. Government lot one was 51.82 acres, and government lot two was 36.30 acres. And I understand appellant's argument that claims that magically in a case, in a general sort of way, that all the excess goes to the parent parcel. But the deeds show that that was not the intention of the parties here. The deeds show repeatedly that according to the government survey, appellants own 112.12 acres, and that's what they owned. Their deed likewise doesn't magically give them more acres between the meander line and the lakeshore adjacent to respondent's property. In this case, we need to remember this lakeshore is not well defined. It's not a nice, tidy, sandy beach that's easily surveyed. Instead, it's predominantly marshland type vegetation. Use of the lakeshore to survey that would certainly result in an inexact determination of the location of the west boundary of the east 16 acres and would not be consistent with the party's intentions as shown by the deeds. We have zero ability to know what the level of the lake was 90 years ago. We have zero ability to know where this marshy shoreline was 90 years ago in 1933. So the 16 acres could be split off in the only way available in 1933 by reference to the government survey and its meander lines. By conveying the 16 acres and the remaining 112.12 acres, this is an available, logical, and mathematically accurate method of computing the location of the west boundary of that 16 acres. The respondent surveyor used this approach of following the meander line shown on the original government survey to determine this dividing line.
We've lost your audio again, counsel. Still not there.
Britt,
there
could
we are.
You take it from there about the...
We can hear you now, Mr.
You Johnson. Have me now? Mm-hmm. My apologies. Respondent has never argued that the meander line is a boundary, but only that the meander line was intended to determine where the west line of the 16 acres would be, as the original government survey was the only known survey available to the parties in the 1930s. Respondent survey was accepted in evidence as Exhibit 4. Appellants never had a survey performed. So in this action to establish a boundary where both respondent and appellants were asking the court to determine the boundaries, appellants never had a survey performed. Instead, appellants hired three different surveyors to throw mud at the respondent survey to see if any might stick. Appellant's proposed westerly boundary of respondent 16 acres was rejected by the trial court as it would lead to an absurd result because the 16 acres would be completely cut off from the public road. I direct the justice's attention to the April 27, 2023 trial court memorandum on page 53, stating that courts will not construe the terms of a written instrument so as to lead to a harsh result or an absurd result, citing the case of Brookfield Trade Center versus County of Ramsey at 584 Northwest 2nd 390, a 1998 Supreme Court case. In the trial court's order and memorandum denying appellant's motion for reconsideration and amended findings dated August 6, 2023, when discussing appellant's rejected theory that the west boundary of the 16 acres can be determined by surveying the shoreline as it exists today, the trial court stated on page 6 of that order and memorandum that it's a fundamental principle of the interpretation of property deeds that they must have a fixed meaning identifiable at the time of conveyance, citing the 1960 Minnesota Supreme Court case of application of Merrick at 100 Northwest 2nd 758. As stated by the trial court, lake levels routinely go up and down, and the actual water line used to measure the area of shoreline routinely fluctuates. If the water level at a particular time in 2023 could affect the meaning of a conveyance in 1933, then that deed would lack determinancy. The trial court went on to say on page 7 of that order and memorandum that in the absence of judicial action, meander lines contained in original government surveys retain legal significance, citing Hansen versus Rice at 92 Northwest 982, a 1903 Supreme Court case.
Mr. Johnston, appellant's
deed says they were conveyed 112.12 acres. Respondent's deed says he owns 16 acres, totaling the actual acreage above the meander line in the original government survey. The fact that the actual parcels contain more than that 128.12 acres because of the additional acreage between the meander line and the shoreline is expected.
Mr. Johnston?
Yes.
What if the deed, the 1933 deed had said East 16 acres, et cetera, with the eastern boundary being the shoreline? Are you saying what are you saying about a deed like that? I mean, it would be explicit. Are you saying it wouldn't be valid?
Well, it would be ambiguous again, because the shoreline is this marshy ground that's very difficult to determine where that shoreline exists.
Is that true in every case involving a body of water?
I would not say every case, no.
So is it but specific certainly to this, in this case?
Okay. I'm sorry.
Is it specific to this case that you think it's?
It's certainly the case under the situation under the facts of this case. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Looks like we've run out of time for you. Do you have a wind up before we returned?
Yes, thank you. You know what your standard of review is. Simply put, the respondent provided a logical, viable, and factually supported theory for the trial court to consider in determining the west boundary of the 16 acres owned by respondent. Appellants did not. Respondent contends there is not a sufficient basis to overturn the lower court and ask that you affirm the trial court decision. Thank you.
I should have asked my co-panelists, are there any other questions for you? I apologize. Okay, thank you. Counsel for appellants, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll touch on several responsive points here, and if there are additional questions, please feel free to interrupt. I would note first, the case law on considering extrinsic evidence is very clear about what kind of evidence can be considered when even looking and construing an ambiguous deed, and that is evidence that does not contradict or add to alter the deed. And so even if you can permissibly look to extrinsic evidence, if the court could here do that, then you're limited. You don't just get an unpermitted field of what that can be. We disagree that there is no ability to develop an understanding of where the lake was in 1933. There was testimony from expert surveyors that the lake appeared relatively stable. There are recognized survey methods for looking at that, and the DNR can set an ordinary high watermark, and we can look to and set something as close to as possible. Will it be absolutely precise? No, but there are methods for that. I would also note that Hansen v. Rice, where the meander line did retain legal significance, is applicable where a lake dries up and there is proof and established relation where we have to apportion additional property, and that's not applicable to the question here. Trial Exhibit 122 reflects the result of surveying Michael's 16 acre lake property deed using acceptable survey methods. Three trial experts testified to this, and they testified to the method and that exhibit reflected the method they would use. Now, it is true, we didn't put forth a survey, but the burden here and how this case was brought by Michael to accept trial exhibit 4, the Johnner survey, what respectfully James and Marilyn were prepared to do upon order from the court was to have a surveyor go out and set those landmarks. And that's just the ordinary sequence of what happens. I mean, that survey, especially because it is going to be looking historically and trying to look at movement of the lake over the past 90 years, is not maybe your ordinary survey. And so it's going to be time intensive and additional cost. And so that's just the natural order and sequencing of how that would work based on the burden of how the case was brought. The prior owners, as Michael's attorney represents, if they were aware of the government survey, they were also aware of the case law that says that if you want to make the meander line from that survey relevant for a deed, you need to be clear and express about that. That case law all predates the 1933 deed. And so even if there's understanding of what the meander line is and was, which it's not clear from the evidence. And in fact, the evidence indicates that that word was quite foreign to all the prior owners here. Then you have the corollary where the state's case law has been clear. We have a default rule. To get out from underneath that default, you need to fit the exception. And in this case, the deed just doesn't comply with that. There's nothing clear about the deed that reflects an intent to use the meander line. Even if the deed is ambiguous, that doesn't imply that there's an intent to use the meander line. It implies there might be methods needed to locate that deed and clear up an ambiguity, correct a legal description. But those two things are not the same.
So I had a question about that. I'm not even sure how to phrase it exactly. But let's say that, in fact, in 1932, the parties did intend to use the meander line because they had, you know, awareness of the, because of the, you know, the math and the previous 1903 deed, et cetera, and the government survey. And I think you've made, I want to understand if there could be, you know, if it was ambiguous and there could be facts that would support a determination that that's what they intended, yet it seemed to contradict case law at the time, or how does that square with the case law at the time? Relative to meander lines. And then also you talked about, well, what would future owners actually understand? And how does that, you know, when they're just looking at it down the road and it doesn't incorporate that in there. So how does one thing trump the other?
So if I'm understanding, I mean, the case law at the time was clear that you could make the meander line relevant. And so we would attribute notice of that to the drafter of these deeds and say, if you wanted to make the meander line relevant, you can do that, but you need to.
Okay, so they couldn't have intended it because we impute to them the knowledge that they needed to say it specifically. So they must not have intended it.
Right. To get out from under the default, you need to be clear. As for the future owners, I mean, that's sort of the bedrock behind deeds. And I see my time is up, but I'll briefly finish the answer. Please. If the court will allow. That the principles behind how we construe deeds are all consistent with that idea of notice and fairness. And so when we're looking back to what a grantor did in 1933, and not finding a clear intent that could have given notice to those future owners and subsequent purchasers, then, I mean, that's just sort of the overarching principles that are consistent across this entire body of well-founded case law. And if this case is affirmed, that entire body is undermined and questioned, and there's going to be significant confusion that arises as to lake property all over the state of Minnesota.
I guess like my question could be like, is you go back to, I guess it couldn't have been intended. Like if we had this very same deed and it was determined to be ambiguous in how you apply it, or we'll say in how it is on the ground. And then they found a letter from the original grantor saying, we certainly do mean to measure this from the meander line. And so you could definitely say that they intended it by extrinsic evidence, but that still wouldn't notify people down the road.
Correct. And Your Honor, and that would then be sort of a different question that you might have firm evidence of an intent. But again, the standard is to convey that in the instrument so that everyone can know the intent. That letter doesn't get recorded. It doesn't become a part of the property record. So you have to have enough of both. Those things may not be the same. So that letter might pair with some different language in the deed itself that sort of comes together to show the intent, and that intent was at least made clear enough in the deed, but it has to be both. And that's what the case law says. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Maybe. I have to ponder, but thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions from the panel? No. Okay. Thank counsel. Thank you both very much. Thank you for your briefing, for your oral arguments. The case is submitted and we'll have a decision out in a statutory timeframe. And with that, we are adjourned on our oral calendar.
Thank you.